Welcome to Words and Whiskey Short Pours, a monthly podcast where we have a fun time discussing fictional worlds and the people that create them, all while boozing just a little bit. Not this week, though. My name is Cross.
My name is PJ.
And this is a great episode that we have for you. I'm very excited again to welcome Rob Hart back onto the show, author of The Warehouse, the Ash McKenna series, The Paradox Hotel, the comic series Blood Oath, and most recently Assassins Anonymous. Also, you're now a best-selling author, so big congrats there, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Super, super excited to talk to you about Assassins Anonymous and kind of this whole path that you've been on over the course of kind of the last couple of years. Talk about co-writing a little bit and whatnot. But I figure for people who don't know, we should probably start with a little summary on the book before we kind of jump in on that end. So PJ, if you wouldn't mind kicking us off there.
In this surprising, witty thriller, the world's most lethal assassin gives up the violent life, only to find himself under siege by mysterious assailants. It's a kill or be killed situation, but the first option is off the table. What's a reformed hitman to do?
So, kicking it off, how did you enjoy this summer's set of Jenny's ice cream flavors?
You know, I haven't gotten to them yet. I'm super disappointed. First off, I'm glad we're getting into the hard-hitting stuff first.
Right, right.
Yeah, no, you know what it is? The thing about Jenny's is that when you want the special flavors, you have to mail order them, and they send them mm-hmm. in a box with like the dry ice and stuff. And my schedule has just been kind of wonky lately. Mm. So I haven't. Yeah, I'm due to put in an order, man.
Fair.
But I think also, you know, having gone on, I went on book tour for this book in the beginning of June, and then I had to go away and teach at the college where I teach. And then I took my daughter to Disney. You know, I think I needed a little bit of break from all the ridiculous food. I'm on a bit of an ice cream break at the moment.
Fair enough.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of employees in my normal day job, of whom were like, we love ice cream. And so they each bought one of those boxes for hitting, you know, some internal goals and whatnot. And they both loved them. So high regards there when you do get to whichever set you choose, if you so.
I mean, Jenny's hasn't made a bad flavor that I've had, and I've had a lot of their flavor.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Transitioning from sweets to this book is actually pretty easy with the intense relationship with hot chocolate that Mark has. But I want to talk about the cover of the book. There is a coffee cup there. Is it filled with hot chocolate or is it coffee? Cross and I were discussing this ahead of time.
Oh, no, it's definitely coffee.
Okay.
So the thing that I loved about the cover, I mean, the Tal Goretsky, the designer who put it together, it's one of those things where it's like, I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what to ask for. And when they sent it to me, I was like, this is so perfect. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Like, I think I told them, I was like, look, I don't care what you put on it, as long as it's not a city skyline or a silhouette of a man running with a gun. Like, otherwise, do whatever you want. And they came back with this. And so that cup is called the Anathora cup. And that design is sort of like the classic, you know, Greek New York deli cup. But they're also popular in recovery meetings. And that's part of the reason they went with that, because of the whole, you know, assassins and recovery thing.
Makes sense. Perfect. Was this the only one that they gave you, or did they give you other cover options?
Yeah, no, this was it. And it's always great when that happens. You know, I mean, I know what the publishers do. Like, they have like 20 options on their side, and they narrow it down to the one they really want, and they send it to me, because they know if they send me two, I might pick the one that they don't like as much. So they always try to remove as much guesswork out of the process as possible. But yeah, no, it's. I haven't had a bad cover yet, but I've never gotten so many compliments on a cover as I have on this one.
It's a great cover. It's really good.
Yeah. To be fair, when I saw it immediately, I was like, "Ooh, this is immediately evocative." Like you were saying, of the AA meetings, the knife straight through the cup and everything else. I was like, "This could not be more perfect for the premise as it was pitched and as you talked to us about last time on the show." So very, very excited for kind of the concept and what's bloomed out of this. I wanted to ask a couple of little questions here. One is Mark. Obviously, there's a lot of inspirations for Mark as a character, this sort of central voice that I really appreciate as a through line. It's obvious from this and sort of any research of any interview that you've done that you're a massive fan of assassin movies. What was the research process like there for you? And what's the one that you'd recommend that everyone sees? that you'd think they have it?
You know, it's interesting because my research process for this was pretty nil compared to my last two books. Because like my last book was a time travel book. My book before that was a giant fuck you to Amazon. And so it was very much about like, you know, capitalism and the economy. On this one, I just kind of sat down and ran with it. I mean, I did read, there was this pretty great book called The Perfect Kill by Robert B. Baer, who was like a intelligence guy who talked about like the whole concept and the history of assassinations. And, you know, I revisited some of my favorites. I did watch a cool little movie with Luke Goss called Interview with a Hitman, which was a really, really fun little movie that I think it was a very small release. So not a lot of people knew about it, but it was cool. I mean, my favorite Hitman movie of all time is The Professional, like by a mile. I love that movie so much. And I was trying to kind of get into that vibe where it was like, you know, these characters are always in books and movies and stuff. They're always like these like supreme badasses who are just like experts at killing people. But the thing is they're also human too. And I didn't want to lose that element. And the thing I love about The Professional is that Jean Reno's character, Leon, is just, he's a deeply sad, lonely man who is like almost childlike because of this, like, you know, and you learn that he has some trauma in his past that kind of, you know, arrested his development a little bit. So it's, I was trying to get towards something like that, toward a character who felt like very human, who you can imagine like sitting down and having a cup of coffee with, but you can also understand like their ability to walk into a room and completely wipe it out in the blink of an eye.
I think you nailed that with Mark. I mean, it's tough not to say, because it is, you get these like juxtapositions of both the flashbacks and the flash forwards that are just so wonderfully rendered, I think, that do show both the very human nature of where he's at now and then also that past of where he was as the Pale Horse. You know, before kind of head down the flashback train, very curious, how'd you feel about The Killer? Did you see that within the last year? Did you watch that at all?
Is that
the Fincher movie?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You know why? Is it came out around the time that I was working on this.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Where I'm like, oh man, I don't want it to sort of bleed into my, like the old ones is one thing. Like I've already got that sort of like built into my head, but like seeing new ones, I don't want to start like adopting mannerisms or voices from someone else. So I've been meaning to get to it, but it's also, you know, I there's this thing, people refer to it as free time. I'm not sure what it is. I'm hoping to find some at some point soon.
Right. With all the touring, co-writing and everything else going on.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Talking about that structure a little bit and sort of the flashback modern day, I'm curious as to why you chose to adopt that method. Obviously, I spoke about it lending humanity, so maybe I've answered my own question here a little bit. But did you also write them in like a chronological sequence, or how did you construct that sort of framing device for the novel?
I mean, so yeah, the story is told, you've got like present day and then present day, flashback, and it goes back and forth like that. And there was a part of that it was a bit of a cheat. You know, I wanted to have my cake and eat it too. I wanted to write a book about a hitman who wasn't allowed to kill anyone, but also had to show him killing people because, you know, that's kind of the fun part. But also, you know, there needs to be some both a demonstration of his ability, because if everyone's saying he's the best hitman in the world, but he's not actually doing the work, then it's, you know, it's kind of like an unreliable narrator kind of thing. But at the same time, I think it was important to show his journey from being like first how he got into the business and why, like why he was well suited for it, but then what brought him to the point that he wanted to quit, you know? And if you don't have that through line, then you sort of, you lose the emotional resonance of him making the decision and saying like, I want to grow, I want to change, I want to be different, you know, how do I do that? And then finding the support group that's going to help him do that.
Definitely makes sense.
Yeah. So kind of feeding off of that, with Singapore being the alternate sort of locale in a lot of the flashbacks and in present day as well. You're obviously well acquainted with New York, but do you have experience traveling to Singapore, or have you spent time there at all?
Yeah. I was there for about a week. This was like pre-COVID. This is years ago. And it was such a cool place. It's bizarre. It's tiny. It's so small. I had an Uber driver who told me he can bike around the entire country in 4 hours. you know, and it's an authoritarian regime. So I mean, I walked most of that country. You know, I was averaging like 20,000 steps a day, and I never once saw a police officer, and also never once felt unsafe. Because, you know, I think the year that I was there, the year prior, the government had put more people to death than people had been randomly killed in the street. So it was like, it's intense, but, you know, the food is incredible. The people were lovely. You know, English is very ubiquitous. So, you know, there were certainly instances where, you know, I would be in like a food hall or something, and I would be like the only white dude there. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. But I also never felt unwelcome, and I never felt like I was struggling to communicate with people. You know, like some of the older folks didn't really speak English as well. You know, because it's a very melting pot country. It's made up of, you know, a lot of Chinese, but also a lot of Malaysian people, a lot of, you know, South Pacific and Indian people. And so, yeah, it was just like really, really fascinating place. And I was like, man, I just want to write about it.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. Wow. And kind of setting that up, it also, because there is sort of this more historical reputation of it being an underbelly, not so much modern day, of course, that it kind of is an interesting kind of feedback loop into the history of Singapore as well. So I kind of, as a personal touchstone, I kind of liked that it's like, oh, bringing, you know, something, of course, like the mob is still going to exist in all kinds of places. And so to bring that as sort of a headquarters and a meeting place and locale, I really liked personally as I was going through. Thought it was great.
Yeah, I had done a little bit of research into that, and there is like some triad activity, triad being like a major like Chinese, like it's like the Chinese version of the mafia.
Yeah,
you know, and there is some triad activity in Singapore, but again, like because of the regime, it's a little bit harder to get away with a lot of things in Singapore.
Makes sense, you know, naturally, and so it all feels together well, and also it lends sort of the travel nature that I think is innate in a lot of assassin stories as well, where they're going from place to place. Obviously, they can't be in the same location all the time. There's got to be a fallback spot. So
yeah,
I really appreciated when reading this as well the quotes at the top of each of the chapters. Did you have like any favorites? Were there any that you left on the cutting room floor? Were you like told to edit any or change any? What was the inspiration there going in?
So that I just thought that would have been fun. Like that's one of those things that it's like most of the ideas I have are like they start from a place of like, oh, this would be cool. But also, I mean, this is about a recovery program for assassins. I have a lot of friends who are in recovery who are very generous and kind with their time in terms of like talking to me about, you know, the process and sort of like signing off on me even writing about it. You're just giving me that extra nudge to say, hey, you know, cool, this sounds awesome. Just treat it with respect because it saves people's lives. And I'm like, yep, of course. And a lot of them joke that a lot of recovery is like recovery is like 60% slogans. So it just kind of seemed cool to do like inspirational quotes. There was one I had to cut. It was a Bruce Lee quote, which was kind of a bummer. And I actually kind of know his daughter, Shannon, and she granted permission for the quote, but there was like another publisher that like owned the book that it was in, or so it turned into like a whole mess. So I replaced it with the Brene Brown quote, which I thought like that just made me really happy because I was like, you know what? I'm going to write this like this badass assassin book with a fucking Brene Brown quote in it.
Funny enough, that is my favorite quote out of the lineup. I literally wrote it. I took it down and put it in our notes here. Grace means that all of your mistakes now serve a purpose instead of serving shame. And that's such a good highlight for that chapter, especially. That's one that I reread right before this. And oh, man, I personally, that was my favorite pick. So it's funny to hear that that's the one that got inserted kind of at the 11th hour in that way.
Yeah.
Not the 11th hour, but.
Yeah, no, that was right at the end, right before we went into page layouts, because I was like, all right, we're not going to get this approval. It is what it is. Let's just kind of move on.
Yeah.
But it also, it kind of tickles me a little bit. I mean, cause I've got like Muhammad Ali in there. I've got the founder of jiu-jitsu, but it's also like, but also, you know, Brene Brown.
The big book as it were.
Yeah.
As well, which is, you know, just a great, great way to quote that in there. Yeah. Cool. Love that.
So speaking of your sort of research into the recovery side of things and, the groups that, or the group that, exists within this book, what sort of went into the composition of the people that populate it? Was the primary set of characters, as it were. Are those based on compositions of groups that you've researched a little bit, or was it just a kind of these are the people and they're in a group together?
It was sort of so this idea, I've had this idea for years and years and years of having like a bunch of assassins in sort of like a group therapy session setting. And the idea didn't really come together until I thought of it in terms of like the recovery process. Cause I'm like, okay, cool. That gives it structure. That gives it a reason for being. And when it came to filling out the room, I just wanted to have like personalities that would bounce off each other and people from sort of like different walks of life. Like, you know, you've got Mark's sponsor Kenji, who was a Yakuza hitter. So he's from Japan. You've got Booker, who is, you know, he was a mercenary, but he was also a U.S. Marine. And then you've got Valencia, who was like, you know, kind of mysterious about her past, though we eventually find out like exactly what sector mm-hmm. she's from. But then sort of the fun thing was adding a serial killer to the mix. And that's actually based around a real debate within the sexual recovery community. Hmm. So within the sexual recovery community, you know, there's a term called MAPS, minor attracted people, or as we know them, pedophiles. And there's a debate within that community of how much they, of whether they should be welcoming minor attracted people into their meeting space. Because on one hand, if someone hasn't offended and they were born with this affliction and they are taking active steps to address it, maybe supporting them is a good thing because it's going to, you know, prevent them from offending. And there are some people who have trauma related to that and therefore don't want to be around that kind of energy, or, you know, who draw the line at pedophilia, which, you know, anyone should because it's terrible. But it's a really, really fascinating debate. And, you know, I'm not part of that community, so I'm not taking a stance any which way. But I thought it was interesting to bring a serial killer into the mix and then create this dynamic of, you know, you've got Mark arguing that like, hey, like he's here. That means he's not killing people. This is a good thing. And you've got Booker saying like, no, but like he killed innocent people. We kill people in the game, you know, like mm-hmm. he doesn't belong here with us. And so it was trying to find these like fun little conflict points within the group itself and see what I can build out of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't considered, I did really appreciate sort of the friction that Stuart brought to the group. And then as such, like kind of Mark taking on the role as sponsor for him at a certain point, of course, without getting into too much spoilers, we'll talk full spoilers in a minute here. But I really liked kind of this emphasis in on the group and then focusing on that. So that totally makes sense as a path of inspiration, because there are, I mean, it even sings back in some ways to like Fight Club of like, do you belong in a recovery group that you don't belong to when you need to recover from something? And it seemed to interrogate that same sort of question for me, at the very least on initial pass. But that makes much more sense to have like that narrow focus of a specific community and the way that they're kind of dealing with that. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of, I don't know that I would call them lovely necessarily, but great segments that are well written around a couple of different subway train incidents. What inspired you to write those segments from the perspective of, I'm forgetting the guy's name off the top of my, or not guy, the description of the guy, but
Smiley.
Smiley. That's it. Yeah.
Smiley. Yeah. That was based on a real life incident. So
I was curious. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the idea is, you know, you've got Mark on the train in the beginning of the book, and you see that like there's this guy harassing this woman, and he shuts it down in a very non-confrontational way, and then mm-hmm. you know, runs across the same guy later in the book when he's slipping, and the interaction is, you know, much, much different. And that was based on so around the time that I wrote that, it was the time that like there was that guy who was having that meltdown on the subway, and then that, you know, stupid kid just like choked him out and killed him. You know, which whole long conversation there about, you know, the way New York City, you know, focuses on, you know, cops and not mental health and homeless services that would actually be useful for the people who are in the subway and struggling. But around that same time, I had had an experience, and this is a guy who I actually saw on the subway, like with some frequency on the A train. You know, and he was this guy, he had like scars on his face, and he was always carrying a bottle. He was a young guy, and was one day I got on the train and he was harassing this woman and it was being really aggressive with her and she was very clearly terrified. So I went up to him and I just started asking him questions. I was like, hey man, what's your favorite color? And you know, and he kind of looked at me, he's like, what the fuck? I'm like, hey, what's your favorite movie? And you know, I trained in Krav Maga for a long time and part of what they teach you is de-escalation. You know, you should always de-escalate. Like, I'm not going to go over and knock the guy out. Like, that's stupid. He could be carrying a knife. He could be carrying another weapon. He's got a fucking bottle in his hand. Like, I don't want to get myself killed, but I'm not going to stand there and watch that happen. So, you know, by asking him questions, I kind of just like it resets his brain a little bit, you know, like this is a proven technique within, you know, de-escalation is just do something that's kind of like a little weird, just to kind of like reset the structure of the tone of the conversation. And so he's like, you know, annoyed at me. He's not happy about what I'm doing, but you know, he sort of like loses focus on the woman really quickly. And then that gives her an opportunity to get off the train at the next station. And I kind of like moved my body around a little bit so he couldn't follow her off. And so it was like, it was one of those moments where it was like, okay, cool. Like we de-escalated this in a way that no one got hurt. You know, I mean, I don't want to get in a fight with the guy. I don't want to get in a fight with anyone. But, you know, it's so I was thinking in terms of that, of like bringing Mark to a place where, you know, it's kind of funny, like someone on the subway kind of like, you know, getting all, like trying to play the tough guy game with him. And, you know, it's some stupid fucking kid who's like full of bravado. And meanwhile, Mark is like literally one of the deadliest people on the planet. And he just kind of brushes it off because he knows like, yeah, whatever, like I could sneeze and you'd be dead. But then I thought it was important to kind of bring that back to show what happens, like the danger of that, the danger of slipping for him, but also why it's not effective to just say like, oh, I see a bad person on the subway doing something. I should attack him. You know, you don't attack, attack is stupid.
Yeah, I think it also does a really good job of kind of, like you said, slipping, of course, but also it kind of tees up whether or not he's like ready to be a sponsor as well and whether or not like he's internalized that lesson himself and whether or not he should be taking those steps. So I really appreciated it. And it seemed by no means self-inserty. So it's interesting to hear that you had that experience, but it seemed like a lived experience by and large. And as I mean, spent a little bit of time in New York, of course, for like a year and a half, but it's so frequent in so many ways. And it's like you said, there just needs to be a little bit more of a focus on mental health as opposed to policing in those situations. And, you know, people stepping up for other people as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, like I'm lucky in the sense that like, I'm a big dude, I'm 6 feet tall. Yeah. I'm, you know, 215 pounds, you know, most of the time, if I stand in front of somebody, they're going to calm down a little bit. And that's as far as I would ever like to take it. Like fighting is like the dumbest thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I trained in Krav, I trained in Muay Thai. I mean, I trained so I don't have to fight.
So you dedicated this book to yourself, and I recently read one of the blog posts that you wrote on behalf of another publication, forgetting the name off the top of my head, detailing kind of the deeper reasons that you did that, being that this was for you and your career as it's taken sort of uncertain turns. Is there any decision along that path that you would have liked to have made differently or that you think about or that, you know, one way or another?
Oh, in my publishing career? Jesus, I could have made a million decisions differently.
I mean, of course, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. That's the danger. It's the Monday morning quarterbacking. It's like you spend so much time thinking like, well, if I had done this differently, if I had done that differently, and but you know, it doesn't matter because the thing is done and you have to move on to the next thing. But yeah, that was a piece for Open Secrets magazine. My friend Rachel runs that. And it was about how, you know, there was this assumption of success with The Warehouse and Paradox Hotel because they were big splashy deals and the books sold good. They didn't sell great. And I need the publishing is moving over to a place of if you're not a bestseller out of the gate, it's kind of like, oh, well, we tried, you know, we've moved away from developing careers into, you know, if you're not an overnight success, it's like, OK, well, we got to go look for the other overnight success that we thought you were going to be. And so, yeah, my publisher effectively dropped me after Paradox, which kind of sucked. And then. So I wrote Assassins from a place of frustration where I was like, okay, fine. Like I spent so much time trying to write something that I thought someone else wanted. I was like, well, you know, I'm just going to write a book that I want to write. So I was like, cool. Yeah, that's my dedication. This one's for me. And it's the fastest I've ever written a book. It came out in like 5 months. And as per usual, I thought like, okay, this is garbage. And I gave it to my agent. I'm like, do what you can. And then he sold it in a preempt to my previous publisher, which is why this business is as lovely and as frustrating as it is.
Yeah, I found that story personally very inspirational, because it is often, you know, there's a lot of sort of self-doubt, I think, for people that are coming into writing in general, but then in addition, like even people of whom are published. I think Robin Hobb threw up a thing that almost timed at the same time, and I'm assuming this is just because I'm so in writer's circles that this happened, but she was like, it took me 10 years to get published the second time after her first book had kind of flopped. So, and that was with Assassin's Apprentice, which ended up being one of the biggest fantasy series of all time, longest fantasy series of all time. So similarly, you know, don't give it up, of course, because every book you've written has been fantastic on that side of things. It's inspirational to see.
That's the thing about publishing, man, is that the crisis of confidence never goes away, ever.
Right.
Like, I still assume it's all going to disappear tomorrow. You know, like I assume that every book I write is just the last thing I'm ever going to write. And then I'm going to have to go back and get another grown up job, which more than anything in the world, I do not want to do. But but yeah, like, I mean, I don't know. I like even writers at the tops of their careers. I don't know any of them who are just completely confident. They're like, yeah, I'm fine. Like Stephen King is probably like, yeah, I'll be fine. Like James Patterson, Michael Connelly, they're probably like, yeah, cool. Then J.K. Rowling is like, I'm fine. I'm just going to spend
all my light it on fire.
Yeah. People. They're all doing okay. It's the rest of us who are just in a constant state of like, how is this still working?
Yeah, that sort of mid-list reality. And we had talked a little bit about off air at some point, had talked a little bit about like short stories and the way that fuels careers as well, and how that has sort of also dwindled in its own way. Do you think that like on the other side of this, is there not enough nurturing in other sort of fictional development spaces like novellas, like short stories and otherwise? And do you think that there are any other shifts in the medium that you kind of see coming in the future for those types of writers and to fuel careers or otherwise? Like where do you think that goes?
Jesus. Let's get into the really depressing shit now. Yeah, man, I don't know. I mean, when I was coming up, there were like 7 or 8 places I could submit crime fiction to. And now, like, I can only think of like 2. There's Tough and Rock and a Hard Place. I can't think of, I mean, and then there are like the stalwarts, like Ellery Queen and Strand. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know that I'm ever going to write a story that's right for those publications. Yeah, I think that it's an economic problem, you know, because the reality is people don't like there's no money in short stories. People won't buy short stories. You know, if I publish a short story in an anthology, I can be sure that the other authors in the anthology and my mom have read it. And that's pretty much it, you know. And then when
I've read Takeout, you know, does that count?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I put them all in a book and that helped a little bit. So some more people read them. And then when it comes to novellas is like a weird, like hinky territory in terms of like the cost of publishing, because, you know, if you've got a novella versus a full size hardcover book, the cost of printing between the two is kind of negligible. So you kind of, but it's harder to justify a full hardcover price on a novella size book. And that's why they tell you like a full size novel, the cutoff on the low end is around 65,000 words. Anything lower than that, it starts getting hard to justify the price that it takes to make a profit. I mean, I know that like everyone's tried to crack the subscription model. No one really has. I think a lot of companies, especially like with short stories in mind, like tried and failed. There was a wave of those like 6 or 7 years ago. I think the only space where I'm seeing some level of success is Amazon. You know, Amazon does the shorts, they do the audio shorts, and those do well, but that's Amazon. Like they're, you know, the producer and the dealer then. So they're selling to a built-in audience. And that's why for me, at least, like I've got some short fiction that I would like to do or explore in sort of like a short story and novella format. And I'm like, well, at this point, Amazon will pay me money and they'll get it out to readers and it'll raise me in the algorithms. I may as well, you know, sort of like move in that direction. So, I mean, As for what I see coming in the future, like, I don't know. I think we're in a weird transitional point with the publishing industry. You know, I think that I don't see a lot of innovation because I think a lot of the innovation over the last 10 years has failed so spectacularly that no one wants to take a chance anymore. They're just like, let's stick with what works.
Fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is doom and gloom, but you know, it's also reality at a certain point, you know, for the way that goes. I think I've seen, you know, to your point of sort of the way that short stories are packaged and sold. I think that Amazon traditionally is the way, you know, that a lot of people are getting those delivered, and in like short story collections of like small bites and pieces are the ways that I've seen that be successful. But, you know, it's sad because I think that as someone who aspires to, you know, whatever else, I've spent a lot of time writing short stories because it's a great way to get things finished and to understand sort of structure and begin to, you know, understand how you're appealing to people and sort of the attention and attraction there. And I feel like the slow death of that art form is sad to me, as far as appreciation goes. But
yeah, it's a bummer. And it's also, you know, we are losing that sort of like proving ground because you're right. The short story format is a good place to start, like, you know, learning how to tell a story. But also, you know, not having to invest like a year or two in doing it before you find out whether or not it worked. And, you know, I look back at like Thuglet, which Todd Robinson ran. You know, Todd's a good friend of mine. And, you know, I always tell him this and he always brushes me off. But yeah, it's just because he's a cranky bastard. you know, Thuglet published me and Jordan Harper and Sean Cosby and Megan Abbott and Brian Panowich and all these authors who went on to sort of, you know, become big five traditionally published authors. Like, and he was publishing us back when we were fucking kids with like one or two credits to our names. So, you know, when you look at like a lot of the, you can go into a bookstore and just start picking off authors that he saw something in and published years before they hit it. And there's not really, that doesn't really exist anymore.
Very true. Yeah. Sad.
Yeah, guys, come on, let's talk about something.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry. We're going to talk about a killer now. Yeah,
let's transition into maybe some spoilery conversations a little bit about the book itself. I believe there's a sequel to it in the works. Am I correct in that?
There it is. I'm going to get off this podcast and I'm going to start working on my copy edits for it.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah, all it's right. Coming. Next summer, it's called The Medusa Protocol.
Nice.
I don't want to be too spoilery just yet, but it actually, Mark is still there, but it moves the focus over to another character. Okay. And that character's journey and past and how they got to where they are as a killer and why they decided to quit. So that was a fun one to write. It's definitely a little wackier than the first one, but you know, I think it came out okay. We're going to find out.
That's exciting. Are there any of the other characters that we've met involved in the story at all, or is it?
No, everyone's back.
All right. Awesome.
And that's the thing I love about this setup is that, like, I mean, I could write a dozen of these because you've got different characters with different stories. You can throw them into different situations. I've got a pitch for the, so this was a two book contract. So I'm out of contract now that the second one is submitted. And we're talking to the publisher about, like, you know, whether they want me to write more of these. And I would like to, you know, as always, it's a business decision. Mm-hmm. But I've got my editor loves the pitch for the third one. Like, and the pitch for the third one's a little weird. It was definitely like, I went into that conversation thinking, like, this is not going to fly. And then when I pitched it to her, she was like, okay, that's weird, but it's pretty awesome. So. So yeah, I'm hopeful, man. Like, you know, there's also the movie option. Like, I hope that works out. Like, it got optioned by Spielberg and Amblin, and I know they're in the process of putting that together. But the Hollywood shit is always sort of like, it could happen, it could not happen. I assume it's not going to happen because it's better to be surprised than disappointed. But you know, we'll see how it goes.
All right.
Yeah, that's the nature of production on that side of things. So that's super exciting on The Medusa Protocol and hopefully more forthcoming novels. I can tell you really, I mean, I would eat the rest of these up, and I'm sure a lot of people would as well, because this is, it's that perfect intersection of like crime thriller and sort of like books. In all honesty, there aren't enough books in sort of the assassin space that are well written. I mean, you know, you invoked Stephen King earlier, and I'm a massive Stephen King fan. I read Billy Summers, and I was mostly disappointed. Versus like Assassins Anonymous was incredible.
Thank you.
It sound right. So yeah, got one over on the King. So
sweet.
So, you know, again, getting into more spoilery questions about the book. So if you haven't read it at this point, I recommend turning around because these are like end game spoilers for it. So for anyone listening, thank you. Be sure to check out Rob's other work, including Dark Space, which is coming out, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a bit here. But what for you went into planning sort of the reveal of Mark's depravity as he kills the love of his life's little brother?
You know, I knew getting him to quit, there had to be a rock bottom, mm-hmm. you know, and that seemed like a pretty solid rock bottom where, like, you know, there's it's kind of the cliche that where like the assassin meets a woman and falls in love and doesn't want to work anymore. But then I was like, well, you know, I gotta take it a step further than that. Like, but the interesting thing is that in my original draft, he doesn't kill the brother. He just beats him like almost like mm-hmm. within an inch of his life, effectively. And my agent read it and he was like, nah, man, you got to do it. You got to kill him. And I'm like, ah, fuck. that felt like almost too much. But then after I wrote it, I was like, oh yeah, no, this makes sense. Like, you can't do a half measure here. You got to do a full measure. And yeah, like I needed it to be something so terrible. And that's also why I worked so hard to make Mark so likable and charming and funny and like the kind of person you want to hang out with. Cause I'm like, you know, once we get to this point, which is like the halfway point of the book, like, you're not going to want to stick with him unless you love him and you feel bad for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can understand why he's on this journey in the first place, which, you know, is absolutely what it does. And it bridges that compelling like flashback narrative and the sort of modern day in a way it's where all of it sort of falls together in that moment. Like you're saying, and I found it incredibly compelling, especially when combined with sort of his deadly nature and his genuine paranoia and fear and, you know, striving for something else and thinking he can have the best of both worlds. And, you know, that's often not the case.
Yeah. You know, it was that thing where he wanted to change, but he hadn't done the work yet, you know, and you have to do the work if you want to change. You can't just snap your fingers and then it's done overnight. And at that point, he was still like a finely honed weapon who was just trying to pretend like he wasn't. He needed to like put those steps and that time and that energy in to sort of like deprogram that.
Awesome. Any particular reason you went with the Pale Horse for Mark's moniker? Were there any others floating around, you know,
on that? No, that one came to me pretty quickly. And part of it is because of The Man Comes Around, Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. He's narrating that Bible verse. And I just thought it sounded kind of cool and it hadn't been done before. And I was worried it was a little cheesy when I started out, but then I kind of fell in love with it pretty quickly. But then it also kind of worked in the sense that I made it that his handler who works at this organization, you know, had like a religious kick and liked to name people after like religious figures. And so it just made it a little bit more interesting for me in terms of like, you know, and I get into that a little bit more in the second book in terms of like thinking about what the afterlife might look like for them.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I was going to say there's a lot of, especially in AA, there's a lot of like redemption obviously is like a core point, but there's a lot of killing going on if you're an assassin. So that is an interesting sort of juxtaposition given the ties of a lot of groups like that are to religious backing, although not religious inspiration, perhaps, but not religious backing. So I'm interested to see how that plays out.
Yeah. And that was another thing about the programs is that, you know, a lot of the language in the programs involves like surrendering to a higher power. And there's always, there are debates within recovery communities about like, you know, that aspect of it, like what that higher power is. Like, is it religion? Is it some greater higher power? Like some people will say, well, it's whatever higher power you choose. It doesn't have to be, you know, the Catholic or Christian God. It can mm-hmm. be anything. But even then there's like this interesting dovetail where, you know, they, and I talk about this in the book where they kind of, you know, to them, it's more that like they kind of decided that they were gods because they had the right to take life mm-hmm. and, you know, who has the right to take a life? So it's, you know, it's just fun little things kind of like tying around that theme that are, especially as like a recovered Catholic myself, it's just fun to play with. Mm-hmm.
I know that.
I think we're all recovered Catholics. on this, so. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the serial killer inclusion in the recovery group. Did you create Stewart with that background? When you created his background, did you have it in mind that he would ultimately become the big bad of the story, or did that kind of evolve after creating the character?
I think I created the character first. I wasn't entirely sure. Like, this is the first book where I ever sat down and like wrote like the first chapter or so, just like off the top of my head, just having fun. And I think that I decided pretty early on, like I was trying to decide like who's going to be in this group, you know, like, okay, we've got a mercenary, we've got someone from special operations group, we've got a Yakuza guy, we've got Mark. Serial killer would be interesting. Like that was the first thought. And then it was like, as I was trying to figure out the end game, I'm like, well, who's got to be after Mark? And it hit me like, oh, it would be really interesting if Stewart's actually pretending, you know? And then makes it even more fucked up when he talks about how he had to go out and kill a bunch of people just so that he can get vetted properly into the organization.
Yeah. It creates kind of a nightmare scenario for Stewart. He's such an interesting character to start with, one that you kind of, I found a little bit of sympathy with, but it's hard to sympathize with a serial killer at the same time. Like, I was just like, oh man, oh, you want better for him, and you get where Mark's coming from. But at the same time, you're like, dude, you gotta not do, how do you tell someone not to do that?
Yep. And yeah, it was kind of fun. This, you know, a lot of my research for the book that I did do was based around the Silk Road, which is the actual, you know, darknet marketplace, where, you know, people were selling like, you know, guns and drugs, but you can also like hire killers and all this other crazy shit. And that got taken down years ago. But the idea of like someone basically like using the information they were gathering there to kind of like start influencing world events, it was like, well, this just feels like the natural step of Facebook. You know, this is what Facebook can turn into.
Yeah, pretty quickly. And I mean, you don't have to look much further, and even YouTube in some ways, you don't have to look much further than the recent like Tenet Media whole thing of like people can and will pay for people and be able to like inoculate themselves. I think, again, you've managed to subtly sort of nudge and predict a thing shortly before, you know, it happened, similar to The Warehouse. So
yeah,
please.
Gonna write a book about me winning the lottery.
That'd be great. That'd be good. in addition, obviously there's a great story within this self of Mark having this cat, of whom follows him around for the entire story. I would be remiss if I didn't bring it up. What led you to create sort of the cast of other characters that follow us around, including, you know, obviously our nurse turned assassin, and kind of everyone else that shows up as sort of the supporting ensemble? Any particular inspirations there?
Well, so for the cat, that was P-Kitty. That cat is named after my grandmother's cat. my brother and sister named him when they were kids. And the cat has since passed, and my grandmother since passed. But I thought it was just like a funny little nod to that. It's just a funny name for a cat. And there's a way in which like that's sort of like, you know, it's an easy way to show that a character is a good person, is like to have them have a good relationship with a pet. But I also kind of like the idea of the cat eventually being the one who saved Mark, like from like an emotional spiral. Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, people have just latched onto that cat and it makes me happy. I'm not even like a big cat person. Like, I don't dislike cats, but I don't have a huge affinity for them. The only thing that I made a mistake on is that my daughter is obsessed with cats, like obsessed. And when she found out there was a cat in the book, she was so mad that I didn't let her name the cat. And I'm like, ah, shit. But yeah, so then Astrid, who is like a black market trauma surgeon, and then you later learn it is a, you know, is an assassin who's been hired to follow him. Yeah, I think she kind of started off as just a black market trauma surgeon. I just thought that was a cool thing. I think she also started off as kind of like a dominatrix, but then I was like, ah, this is getting weird, you know? But I thought when I kind of realized like, oh, it would be really cool if she was an assassin too, you know, then things clicked in a big way for me. And so, yeah, so Medusa Protocol is her story.
All right.
And I'll tell you, the opening of the book is she ends up kidnapped and thrown into a cell in a like a black site prison, and she has no idea why. And that's it. And then you jump to like a month later where Mark is just assumes that she's dead or that she's like gone out or she's relapsed or something. And then he receives a message from Astrid, and then almost instantly the group is attacked by a bunch of mercenaries. So that's kind of like the opening of the book.
Good hook. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun one. There's some weird shit in that book.
I am so excited now. The heel turn of Astrid was one that I found obviously like the assassin reveal, and then sort of the culmination of that final sort of sequence when everyone kind of turns on Stuart and we managed to take him down. I think was just excellent as far as composition goes. When you see this adapted, is there anything that you worry would end up be on the cutting room floor? Anything that you think that they might change? I think it's pretty straightforward, in all honesty, from an adaptation perspective.
Honestly, like. I mean, I had a great conversation with Lauren Abrams, who was the executive who did the option of the book and is working on it now. And I told her, I was like, look, you know, the only thing that's really important to me here is that I don't want to see them just like throwing all the recovery stuff away and then murdering everyone at the end. Like the recovery stuff has to mean something. And she was like, no, we totally get that. We totally understand that. You know, and that's part of the reason that I went with them is because they seem to have very clear care and understanding of that part of the story. Because I don't want to happen what happened with Death Wish with Brian Garfield. Like, I don't know how familiar you guys are with that. But so the movie Death Wish with Charlie Bronson is based on a novel by Brian Garfield. And the thing is the novel, which is great and I highly recommend, is a repudiation of violence. It's a repudiation of vigilantism. It's about how it's bad. And then they made it into a movie where Charlie Bronson is just like killing, you know, black and Hispanic people like indiscriminately. And Garfield hated it so much. He ended up writing a sequel called Death Sentences that was supposed to be almost like an apology for what the movie did. Hmm. And so yeah, it's that would be my only fear if they turn it into like a cheering section, like a John Wick movie halfway through. But I trust them, you know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, I ultimately accept that things have to change no matter what, going from a book to a screen. I can live with that as long as the check clears. And as long as they, you know, as long as they don't completely whiff it on that, but the rest, I don't know. Like, it's interesting. I know there was one actor in particular they were going to go out to, and I don't think it worked out, but it was like such a left field choice and it's not someone I would have chosen, but I was like, you know what? Cool. Like I could see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Those are always fun picks, and like adaptation is such an interesting beast in and of itself. So I appreciate kind of the insight there. PJ, did you have anything else in the book that you wanted to hit before we talk about other
stuff? Oh, I did have one kind of left field thing a little bit. Last time we talked, you were fiddling around with the lockpick, and we talked about that a little bit. So
oh, yeah.
There's that one scene in Singapore where he like uses the snake pick to rake open the door. Did you like want to geek out a little bit more on the lock picking stuff and
oh yeah,
incise it down a little bit? Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, I think it's, you know, and it's a little tiny detail, but I think it kind of underscores his authority in the sense that like, he knows what he's doing. Like, you know, and the thing is like, it also underscores my ability as the author that I know what I'm talking about, because like, if I say he picked the lock, you know, that's fine. But if I say he used, you know, a snake hook to rake the lock, like that's a different thing. Like that's because that's the technique, that's the terminology. And then, you know, even if you don't know exactly what it means, you know that I've at least done my research and I, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, no, my lock pick set is like a favorite for when I'm doing podcasts and stuff. Cause I usually like today, it's my daughter's little, the stress donut that she got me, which I love. Like she's 9 and this kid is so emotionally smart. Like she'll see, like when I get agitated about something or really frustrated, she'll just be standing next to me and she'll just hand me the stress donut. she won't even say anything. And then she'll just go back to what she's doing. I'm like, you are a good kid. Thank you.
That's perfect.
That's so good. I've got like a little magnet that I've been playing with of late. So yeah, pretty much everyone has something, I think, when to occupy their hands when you're like talking in front of other people for so long. So yeah. I get it. That's so cool. It also, stress donut makes less noise than a lockpick set.
Yeah, that was the problem with the lockpicks. This mild clicking sound.
Yeah.
Whenever I was on a podcast, and I'm like, I got to stop doing that.
If you've got good sound editors, then it really doesn't matter. But, you know, on the other side,
I don't want to run through that.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So I think that on the other side, PJ, any other questions? I love
Lockpick. I'm good. I'm good.
Glad you got that in. So you've been on a bit of a writing journey, like we were talking about earlier, doing a lot of co-writing of late. And your next upcoming novel coming out is co-written with Alex Seguera. Yeah. And recently announced other projects as well. Very exciting. What attracts you to co-writing, and what excites you about that process?
I mean, it's fun when you have more than one person in the room to spitball ideas, because when it's collaborative, you know, I've been lucky in the sense that the people I've collaborated with, you know, we don't have egos about it. We know the best idea has to win. But being able to sit there with someone and say, like, oh, but what if we did this? And then they're like, oh, cool, but what if we did this too? You know, that's just a fun process. You know, from a financial perspective, I think that's just where publishing is. Like, you know, you can't survive publishing a book every 2 years. Like, you need to be, you know, kind of moving, especially if you want to do this full time. And if I can co-write a book with someone, that's going to move a lot quicker than it is if I'm writing solo. And it's going to open me to, like, new avenues. And yeah, you know, this is my second collaboration with Alex. We did the comic book Blood Oath. I mean, we also did a novella, like, years and years and years ago. But yeah, the novel was a great time. And then the project that I just finished is called Detour. That's with Jeff Rake, who is the showrunner and creator of Manifest, the TV show. And it's been a blast working with him. Like, but also he's a TV guy, so he gets it. Mm-hmm. Like, he's used to that, like, collaborative, like, writing room process. And we had so much fun. And it's cool because it's also scratching my science fiction itch a little bit. You know, like, Detour and Dark Space are very sci-fi, whereas I've been kind of skewing back toward more like modern thrillers.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm personally pretty excited for the sort of step into a little bit more speculative fiction, in addition to continuing down, hopefully, this Assassin's Anonymous sort of train as it rolls forward. So it's great to see kind of both paths. Is there anything that particularly attracts you to writing the speculative versus or otherwise? Like, what's your preference?
I don't know that I have a preference, man. Like, it's just sort of like wherever there's an interesting story is where I'm going to go. You know, like, I'm currently like, if you can see behind me, the mermaid on my I'm currently working on a sort of like a young adult middle grade book because I want to write something that my daughter can read. Because every time I write a new book and it comes in, she's like, can I read this one? And I'm like, no, you can't. But she's a good little reader. And it would, like, I've got a really, really fun, like, fantasy idea that would be like, and it's a genre I've never written before and it terrifies me, but it's also a story that I feel very connected to because it's about a dad and his daughter. And, you know, I just kind of want to go where the fun ideas are. You know, whether that's speculative, whether that's thriller, whether that's fantasy, like, I'm just in this to have a good time.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah. I really appreciate kind of all of the breadth of the career that you're striving for. I obviously saw the note the other day on sailing, so I assumed you're kind of heading in a speculative, maybe fantasy direction. So
yeah.
I don't know an expert, but
God, you know, okay, here's the thing. I'm gonna complain for a second.
Do it.
I go on social media, and for Medusa Protocol, I needed a snake expert, someone who is an expert in snake venom. I get like 10 people, 10 names that I can choose from. Like, it's amazing how many people know snake experts. I go on. What else was it that I was looking for? I was looking for like ancient map making techniques for the fantasy book. And I get like 3 or 4 solid leads for people to talk to. Not a single thing on sailing.
And sailing is still an art form, you know, to some degree. Like, it's a thing
that would be the easiest one. And now I've taken to like, I've been emailing like sailing schools being like, hey, will someone please spend an afternoon with me explaining to me how this shit works? I cannot believe like the amazing, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, 10 to 15 snake experts that I could have chosen from easily.
Huh. Why? No idea. Snake people.
Yep.
Fair enough. PJ, were you going to say something?
I don't know if this will get cut out or not, but my brother-in-law was a pilot of a destroyer.
Like the, I went to Danielle, the restaurant in New York. I took my partner there for her birthday, and that's like a 2 Michelin starred, like crazy fancy pants restaurant. They've got like a white cosmopolitan that's like their house drink, and it was the most beautiful and the most amazing drink that I've ever had in my life. But yeah, no, I would say it's weird. Like I'm kind of like at the point where I didn't get a summer vacation. Like I spent most of the summer working and traveling. And now it's like, I've kind of hit a point now where my brain is just kind of like disintegrating a little bit. Like I filed Detour, which has been in the offing for a while. Like I'm sort of like at a point where I'm not actively working on something. I'm working on like 20 different things, but yeah, it's like you asked me like when was the last time I had a good cocktail, and my brain is just like no. we're not digging, we're not looking, we're not processing information right now. You calm the fuck down and relax. You know?
Yeah.
Fair. It's weird. Like I only say this because I've come across this like a couple of times recently where someone's asked me a question and my brain has just gone blank and is like, no. Not participating.
Funny. Similarly, is there any like TV show or movie that you've seen recently that you'd recommend? I know you go to the movies all the time with your daughter and otherwise, but anything stand out?
Oh,
or
man.
Brain say no.
Have you guys seen Rebel Ridge yet?
No, but that's on my list this weekend.
Yes. My God, that movie. That is like all the hype, like totally deserved. Totally deserved. It was funny because it's a thriller, it's a crime thriller set around the idea of civil forfeiture, which is about how the police like can decide like, oh, we think the money you have is through a drug deal, so we're just going to take it from you, and then they never give it back to you. And this is like a very real thing, and it was a law that was created to fight drug cartels, but in reality, it's abused by police departments around the country to literally just like take money away from people. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I've been like, oh man, like that would be that's a really cool concept to like build a story around. And then I watched this movie and I'm like, nah. They knocked it so far out of the park. They did such a good job on it. I'm like, I'm not even going to bother. Like, I don't even feel bad because it was so good. But yeah, no, highly recommended.
I just rewatched Molly's Game this last week, and a big portion of that story, of course, the Aaron Sorkin movie, is civil forfeiture as like all of her assets were taken away. And I was like, oh man, that is an interesting premise. So I refuse to watch trailers, but Rebel Ridge caught me just from like seeing people talk about it in reviews and otherwise. So I'm very excited to get to it on that side of things.
Yeah, yeah. I also saw Aliens Romulus, and that was pretty good. It was definitely sort of like weird in the sense that I feel like we're leaning too far into like remix culture, where it felt like just like a remix of all the previous movies, in ways that were both subtle and like blindingly obvious. But at the same time, it was like certainly it was exactly what I wanted from an alien movie. It was a little scary, a little violent, and very, very gross.
Fun. That is exactly the formula for a good alien movie. Similarly, like Prey, I think actually is the best example of doing that well, I think, into.
Prey was awesome. Because that's the thing. And like, look, nothing against Sigourney Weaver, right? Mm-hmm. Sigourney Weaver's great, but not every alien movie has to be about her, you know? And this is the thing that they kind of figured out with Romulus is like, if you just figure out another premise and just drop aliens into them, you know, that's interesting. Like, I love this idea of like, just keep on making Predator movies and just keep on dropping him into like different time periods. Like the next one is supposed to be like a post-apocalyptic wasteland and the Predator shows up. Like, that's awesome. Like, you should have a Predator show up in like, you know, Edo era Japan and like fight samurai. Yeah. Like, come on. Like, this is the star is the Predator. It's not the human actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with the Predator having like a code of honor, that would be really interesting from the Edo Japan sort of setting and styling. Great idea. Man, that'd be fun. All right, PJ, any other questions? Anything else you hanging on to?
I'm good.
Rob, anything else that you want to bring up?
That's it. I'm just, I'm so glad I got a chance to hang out with you guys for a little bit again.
Yeah, it was so good to have you. Obviously, if people want more of you, they can. Where can they find you? And what else is coming up? We talked about it a little bit, of course, but
sure. Yeah, my website is robwhart.com. I'm mostly on like Instagram and Threads these days, which is robwhart1. And then, yeah, Dark Space comes out on October 8th. If you're local to New York City, we're doing a release party on October 12th at PT Knitwear, and that's all sort of like on my social media and stuff. And yeah. So I Detour is like not even coming out until like 2026. So whatever.
Is Medusa Protocol maybe 2025 then? Or yeah,
that should be, presumably that'll be the summertime, probably a year after Assassin. So I'm thinking like beginning of June. But honestly, like I'm not even sure yet. So so yeah, right now it's all Dark Space all the time.
Cool. Awesome. Very exciting. Can't wait to read it. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about that one. I know it's so close. And last time we were like, we'll do it. And then everything convened to push us off to this point. But thanks for making the time for us and for having this chat. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening to our show.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thanks, of course, to our guest, Rob Hart. Be sure to check him out on social media, as mentioned previously. You'll also be able to find all those links within the show notes here, so you can check him out. Great follow, very funny, always has media recommendations, which is why I always find it important to ask him for a little something-something, because he keeps the finger on the pulse, as it were. So we've got a lot coming out, though, beyond that, on the Atomic Pylon Media Network, so keep your ears tuned for more. As mentioned, maybe not mentioned, but at this point, in terms of short pours that we're looking forward to, we've got one that's already recorded and released to patrons that is on Has Been Hotel, which is a great little episode that includes the rest of my family, the rest of my siblings, including my brother-in-law, and PJ, of course, and we kind of get into it. It's a long episode talking about musicals and talking about cartoons and this nice, incredible confluence that is sort of Has Been Hotel. Beyond that, we also have another episode coming out on Iron Widow, of which I haven't finished reading yet. It's been a long, long year, but I'm going to be doing that next. So very excited to read and talk about that. So those are our next two short pours, as it were. Other than that, make sure you're following along with us for all of our coverage on Joe Abercrombie's First Law.
You can also check out the... We already said to check out the show notes. I'm just in my patter a little bit. but in the show notes, you will also find our Patreon, our previous episodes, our website, all of our social media accounts, which are as follow: at Words Whiskey Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Reddit, wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com, and patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey.
Beyond that, we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.